Iran tells the visiting EU coordinator for the Vienna talks that an agreement on the revival of JCPOA can be reached if the U.S. acts pragmatically. Day 32 of Russia-Ukraine conflict. Kiev announces an agreement for the evacuation of civilians from frontline areas, including Mariupol. In a rare public message of support, Israel sympathizes with Saudi Arabia over the latest wave of Yemeni retaliatory strikes. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The top story this hour, Iran saying an agreement on the revival of the JCPOA will be within reach in case the U.S. acts pragmatically. Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri-Kenny made the announcement this morning in meeting with Enrique Mora, the visiting EU coordinator for the Vienna talks. The meeting is part of consultations aimed at patching up remaining differences in the months-long talks between Tehran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal. Head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations has called for the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps to be removed from the list of terrorist groups.
IRGC is a national army, and a national army cannot be listed as terrorist group. And certainly it is not acceptable. That is very important for Iranians.
Kamal Kharrazi made a call at the Doha Forum. Also present at the session was U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, who said that Washington has not yet decided to delist IRGC as a terrorist entity. He said many of the sanctions on Iran will remain on IRGC will remain in place. With regard to the Vienna negotiations on the Iran deal, Malley said an agreement was close but not imminent after 11 months of discussions. Iran demands economic guarantees and the removal of all U.S. sanctions in exchange for a return to its commitments under the deal. Now let's continue with the latest on the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The two countries have agreed to open two humanitarian quarters to evacuate civilians from frontline areas. A senior Ukrainian official says that under the agreement, people will be allowed to leave the southern city of Mariupol in private cars. Meantime, Russia is pressing ahead with its military operation that it says is aimed at degrading Ukraine's military potential and decapacitating neo-Nazi groups. Moscow says it has hit military targets in the western city of Lviv with high-precision cruise missiles. This is the most significant attack on the city in the months-long war. Meanwhile, the Ukraine says it has repelled seven attacks in the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. The Ukrainian president is urging Western states to provide his country with weapons and military hardware so it could defend itself against the Russian attacks.
What is the price of this security? This is very, very specific. It is planes for Ukraine. It is tanks for our state. It is missile defense. It is anti-ship weapons. That is what our partners have. That is what is just gathering dust there. After all, this is all not only for the freedom of Ukraine, but for the freedom of Europe.
Speaking in a video address on Saturday, Zelensky said that Ukraine is asking for just a tiny fraction of NATO's arms, not more. He also asked Europeans if they are afraid of Moscow and warned again that Russia's military operation could endanger the whole Europe. Zelensky insists that Russia will seek to expand further into Europe if Ukraine falls. But NATO does not back his request for a no-fly zone on grounds that it could provoke a wider war. Zelensky has also talked to his Polish counterpart and demanded a rapid transfer of Russian-made fighter aircraft from Eastern Europe to Ukraine. The U.S. president has raised eyebrows after suggesting that his Russian counterpart should not remain in office.
We will have a different future, a brighter future, rooted in democracy and principles, hope and light, of decency and dignity, of freedom and possibilities. For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power. God
bless you all. In response, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says that the Russian president is elected by the people of Russia, and it's not up to Biden to decide who should be in power in that country. The White House later explained that Biden wasn't calling for a regime change in Russia. It said that the U.S. president meant to say that Putin cannot be allowed to exercise power over its neighbors or the region. Okay, that's all we had about Ukraine for now. Now, moving on, in a rare public message of support, Israel has extended sympathies to Saudi Arabia following a flurry of Yemeni strikes on multiple targets across the kingdom. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett expressed Israel's sorrow to Riyadh over the attack, which he described as horrific. He was referring to a wave of missile and drone strikes that the Yemeni army conducted on several sites deep inside Saudi soil on the 7th anniversary of the war 2 days ago. The strikes caused a huge fire at an Aramco oil storage facility in Jeddah. That's why the regime has no formal relations with Saudi Arabia. But the UAE and Bahrain, both allies of the Saudis, normalized ties with Israel 2 years ago. In January, Tel Aviv offered security and intelligence support to the UAE after a deadly Yemeni strike hit its capital, Abu Dhabi. In the meantime, Yemen has announced a unilateral ceasefire, suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia, affirming its readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announce the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
Mashat says Saudi Arabia must end its blockade on the Republic of Yemen once and for all. It says that Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange. He urged a UN special envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. Meantime, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says that Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to the Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and pulling out troops. The developments follow Yemeni armies targeting multiple locations in Saudi Arabia, including an Aramco oil facility in Jeddah and vital sites in the capital, Riyadh. Thousands of people in Yemen have taken to the streets of the capital, Sana'a, and several other cities to mark the National Day of Resilience. Abdul Latif al-Washali was also there among the ralliers and filed us a report.
Following one of the largest retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a and other major cities to mark the National Day of Resilience.
The Yemeni people are free. 7 years of crime have passed against us, but this has been matched by 7 years of steadfastness, freedom, and defeat of the enemy. The Yemeni army has manufactured weapons, including ballistic missiles and drones, and this is by the grace of God. And as Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said, now a new phase of confrontation with the Saudi enemy will begin. Our big gathering today is to confirm that we will remain steadfast until we win and expel the occupier.
The protesters expressed their support for the army's recent aerial operations, saying the Saudis only understand the language of force and it is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense against Riyadh's war and siege.
All the Yemeni people are supporting the operations which has been against the Saudi facilities, economic facilities, and also military facilities. We are revenging violations have been committed against the Yemeni people since March 2015, and we are very sure that we are now in the year of victory.
On Friday, the Yemeni army launched fresh attacks against several targets in Saudi Arabia. The attacks caused a heavy blow to Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan and Najran, as well as Ras Tanura and Rabigh refineries. The Yemeni army said it has also targeted vital sites in Riyadh with ballistic missiles.
People here say the 8th year of the war will be different, as the Yemeni army has already proven that it is capable of hitting Saudi targets, including its oil facilities. The Yemenis believe that Riyadh will eventually have to consider a political solution, at least to protect its oil giant Aramco in the face of Yemeni attacks. Avlatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The war on Yemen has entered its 8th year. The brutal Saudi-led campaign has been nothing short of death and destruction, marked by diseases and malnutrition. Countless people have died as a result of bombardments. While the world mourns what is happening in Ukraine, Yemen is not given the attention it deserves. Meanwhile, the main driver of the war, the United States, continues providing arms to Saudi Arabia and the coalition it backs.
Saudi Arabia's brutal war on Yemen has entered its 8th year. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with a number of its allies, launched a bloody war against Yemen. The United States and several Western countries, including France and the UK, provided the Saudi-led coalition with arms and logistics support. The armaments that the U.S. has been providing the invading coalition have included precision ammunition, which the Saudi-led aggressors have been using amply against residential areas and other civilian targets. Soon after Riyadh began the war, the Pentagon started assigning a commando unit to the border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen to help the kingdom in the face of Yemeni defense forces' increasingly sophisticated retaliatory attacks. American military personnel have also been attending command and control centers on the Saudi and Emirati territories so they can best advise the countries about how to proceed with the war.
The Saudi regime, along with the UAE, backed by the United States and its allies in the region, including most notoriously Israel, continue to push for a wide-scale military operation against Yemen and the Yemeni people.
The objective was to return to power the former Riyadh-backed regime and to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of an effective government in Yemen. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, a Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
They are fighting against these imperialist forces that are coming to destroy Yemen. And so we see that continuously the Saudis, along with Sudanese mercenaries, the UAE, and other mercenary forces, backed by U.S. and Israel and NATO countries, continue to provide weaponry to bombard and kill indiscriminately civilians, to destroy civilian infrastructure.
Now, France's presidential election has been unlike any other in recent memory, with apathy and disinterest dominating headlines. It's the first major vote in the West since the end of the COVID, and that may explain why France appears unusually politically disoriented. Rami Mazahari reports.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election, the surging left may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far-right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals, economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression.
We are here to protest against the abusive government and this kingship presidency of Emmanuel Macron. The Yellow Vests are here to promote a true vision of democracy and to redistribute our nation's wealth. Every election there is more and more abstention because people don't believe in mainstream politics anymore.
In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the Yellow Vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun. An unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just one day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election.
France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Rahman Mazahiri, Paris.
Well, that's a wrap for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
All great economic decisions should be defined on the basis of the economy of resistance. Imagine that we sign a financial or industrial contract with such and such a country. It should become clear where in the economy of resistance this contract is situated. If we think that the economic improvement of the country is achieved only through foreign investment, this is a mistake. Of course, foreign investment is a good thing, but it fills in only one of the blanks on the table. What is more important than foreign investment in activating domestic capacities? We have many dormant capacities that should be activated. This is more important. Of course, foreign investment is necessary to exist alongside. But if we make everything dependent on foreign investment, this is also a mistake.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes it is said that they bring new technologies with them. Very well, this is all right. We agree with bringing in new technologies, of course, if they really do so. However, even if they do not bring them, as I have said before, can our youth, who have made achievements in the area of nanotechnology, in the nuclear area, and in the area of building complicated technologies, and who have helped Iran to be among the first of 5 to 10 countries in the world in many areas, not do something to make our oil wells produce more oil? Can they not improve our oil refineries? Or can they not improve the other areas which need to be improved and in which we need foreign technology? Certainly, if this technology is transferred during our transactions with foreigners, this is all right with us, and we do not have any objections. Notice that today, meticulous analysts who work on economic and political matters of the world bet on our country's economy of resistance. The issue is of which such great importance and sensitivity. They argue and bet on whether the economy of resistance that Iran has brought up will or will not produce results. It is of such tremendous importance. Therefore, this defines our independence. This was the third criterion that we discussed.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In yet another act of Israeli aggression against the Palestinians of Gaza, Israeli planes sprayed toxic chemicals on the eastern perimeter of the coastal enclave. Israeli crop duster planes sprayed herbicides at least twice this week on Gaza farming areas. The Israeli regime regularly sprays Palestinian agricultural lands near the so-called buffer zone with dangerous substances which destroy the crops. For more than a decade, Israeli planes sprayed Gaza's farmlands several times a year, destroying various crops.
The Israelis spread
herbicides to the farmers' land beside the border in order to prevent them to plant in their land, to push the farmers out of their land and leave their land without any trees in order to feed them for their food security and for their children.
Spraying unknown toxic substances on Gaza's farmlands may have long-lasting effects on the environment. Gazan farmers say they are struggling to make ends meet due to Israel's inhumane practices.
Israel sprays our farmlands with poison. The chemicals that they spray don't kill the weed on the fence. They only kill our crops. We suffer heavy losses when Israel sprays our land because it's killing our crops and poisoning our farmlands.
Israel claims that it sprays what it described as weed killers for security reasons, but experts say the Israeli regime aims to destroy the livelihoods of farmers.
Using such herbicides on Gaza Strip by the Israelis, it's kind of offensive towards the Palestinian farmers. At the same time, towards the Palestinian food security, these areas are feeding the Palestinians with the needed vegetables and other kinds.
Rights groups say the suffering of farmers and their families in Gaza reflects the scope of Israeli human rights violations. Gazan farmers have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and war since 2007. Now experts say that Israel's poisoning of crops will make a bad situation worse and harm vital sources of food in the territory. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As the world's eyes are on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Saudi led war in Yemen is still taking the lives of more civilians and pushing the country to the brink of famine. A recent UN report says 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure, and the number is likely to go up to 19 million by the end of the year.
Unfortunately, the United Nations reports did not clarify the main reason for the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The only solution to end the humanitarian crisis is to lift the siege and allow Yemenis to import food and medicine.
Back in 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war in Yemen to bring back to power former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of people, including women and the children, have lost their lives since then.
I was sitting in my house with my children in the evening, and suddenly a missile struck the next house. The explosion destroyed my house as well. We were so afraid.
Saudi warplanes targeted our neighborhood. Look at the destruction. This is a crime, and unfortunately, the world's watching in silence.
The Saudi war has impacted all aspects of civilian lives in Yemen, including the healthcare system, which is on the verge of collapse. This comes amid the ongoing fuel shortage, as Saudi Arabia keeps detaining Yemeni oil ships, despite the fact that the vessels have UN permits.
We suffer from a severe lack of fuel. We cannot operate medical devices without electricity, not to mention the lack of medicines and medical solutions. There is overcrowding in the medical centers. Unfortunately, the United Nations did not provide us with anything other than media statements. The international community must stop Saudi Arabia from seizing Yemeni oil ships.
Children are the most affected people by Saudi Arabia's war. The rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world, and the situation continues to deteriorate.
More than a million children are suffering from malnutrition in Yemen, and I believe the number is greater than this. And we are coming to a worse period because we do not have the most basic needs necessary to save the lives of sick children, such as milk, solutions, and medicines.
Observers say the years-long Saudi war in Yemen has only created the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. They say years of failure should be enough for Riyadh to start looking for other means to get rid of the quagmire it stuck with its war in Yemen. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
On Thursday, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Beirut to hold talks with Lebanese officials. Abdullahian expressed his country's willingness to provide aid to Lebanon in different fields, especially in the economic and commercial sectors.
Almost a month ago,
I met with Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mirati in the Munich summit, and I informed him about the Islamic Republic of Iran's readiness to assist Lebanon in building two power plants, where each would provide 1,000 megawatts of electricity. This is in addition to Tehran's readiness to cooperate with Lebanon in economic development and other fields.
Abdullahian met with top Lebanese officials to discuss bilateral ties as well as latest developments in the region. President Michel Aoun stressed during his meeting with the Iranian minister that any progress in the Vienna talks as well as negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia will have positive impacts on the region and the world. During his talks with Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri and Prime Minister Miqati, Abdullahian touched upon the significance of the upcoming parliamentary elections in Lebanon. As Lebanon is dealing with economic crisis, some experts believe U.S. bans on any dealing with other Asian states, especially Iran, has exacerbated Lebanon's problems.
The U.S. pressure and the Western country against the Iranian commitment to help Lebanese people in supporting their living, of daily living, this is what prevents the Lebanese government from receiving the funds and the support of the Iranian people and Iranian government. As people and as local authorities in Ghubayri, we welcome for any support coming from the Iranian people, first of all, and the Iranian government for the sake of better survival.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also held a meeting with the Iranian minister where they discussed developments in Lebanon and the region. Abdullahian met with Palestinian factions and reiterated Iran's support for the full liberation of Palestine. The Iranian foreign minister has reiterated the Islamic Republic of Iran's previous calls to build two electricity stations, which could substantially resolve Lebanon's energy crisis. However, Lebanese officials seem reluctant to face U.S. intimidations and work with Iran, or even China for that matter, to change Lebanon's dire conditions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Due to the conflict in Ukraine and Western sanctions against Russia, it has never been more costly to buy essential food items in the European Union, and the situation is set to get much worse. The world's biggest wheat producer is Russia. The third largest is Ukraine.
Wheat is a very good example. When I say wheat, we are actually talking about bread to feed people.
In fact, wheat prices have risen by 70%. The European Commission has just unveiled plans to support food producers and reduce tax to 0% on certain food items. €330 million has been announced to support Ukrainian farmers.
They need, for the spring sowing campaign, they need 50,000 tons of fuel per week.
Animal feed stocks are on the decline. Campaigners say millions could starve in East Africa if EU leaders don't do more to help poorer nations. Syria and Yemen have also been singled out for needing special support.
There are in fact 14 low-income countries which depend for more than 50% of their wheat imports on these two countries, on Ukraine and Russia.
The European Commission has presented new legislation to make it mandatory for member states to ensure 80% gas reserves are put in place before November. Experts say that is wishful thinking. 3.5 million Ukrainian refugees have now arrived in the EU. Most countries in the bloc have failed to take in their fair share, but some already have.
Poland is in top. The country number two is Austria. The country number three is Cyprus. Country number four is Czech Republic.
Almost €3.5 billion has been set aside from the EU budget to support refugees, including 1,470 unaccompanied children who have arrived in the bloc from Ukraine. Some nations are saying it's simply not enough money. EU leaders will hold a summit here on Thursday and Friday to consider, amongst other things, a request from Poland for new funding towards the cost of dealing with the growing refugee crisis. All indications so far suggest that request will be rejected. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Over the past week in France, social unrest has been a near daily occurrence. But it may be an everyday issue now and until after the presidential election. Public transport unions in Paris have called an unlimited strike starting March 25th over rampant inflation. Reduced purchasing power was the number one election issue in 2017 and 2012, But the unrest in Ukraine and the European Union's response to it has sent costs haywire. The increases arrive after a decade of right-wing austerity measures, which suppressed wages, reduced social services, and decreased job stability, leaving the average person especially vulnerable to record-high prices. Across the nation, unions were already protesting in an immediate response to President Emmanuel Macron's promise to raise the retirement age to 65. It's a bold gambit, given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people die before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late, and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the average person, but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public.
France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election, but regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians.
Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking delegation. He met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed the implementation of bilateral cooperation agreements.
Talks covered cooperation in fighting terrorism, in which Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria for the full liberation of all its territories. The top diplomat briefed President Assad on the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Assad hailed Iran for adhering to principles and rights and the track adopted during the negotiations. He asserted that reaching a deal has become more important in service of Iran and the region's interest, as well as international equilibrium.
We had good meetings with President Assad and Foreign Minister Faisal Maqtad. We welcome the new approach by some Arab states in restoring relations with Syria. We reaffirmed Iran's readiness to develop relations with Syria and discuss increasing the level of tourist exchange. We hope that in the near future, the presidents of both countries would meet.
A separate meeting was also held between the foreign ministers of Syria and Iran. Focus was laid on the notable increase of trade exchange and means of overcoming the impact of economic sanctions on the two countries.
We discussed means of confronting unilateral illegal sanctions on both states, as well as developments currently happening in the meetings of the Syrian Constitutional Committee in Geneva. Syria and Iran's stances are identical in this regard. We are in favor of a successful result. However, the other side is not working for national interests.
Syria was the first destination of the regional tour of the Iranian delegation, which also includes Lebanon. Abdullahian's visit is one of many exchanged between both countries' officials. It signals the extensive and continuous cooperation between the two allies at all times, which resulted in a defeat of terror in Syria and currently aims to boost economic partnerships. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Poland's support for fellow Europeans fleeing Ukraine is receiving much praise. However, this has been a huge turnaround, for in past years, the Eastern European country has been heavily criticized for a proud anti-immigration stance, particularly hostile towards Muslim refugees.
Angela Merkel started this madness, and now this is a problem about Muslims mainly coming to Europe.
Amid the anti-Islam rhetoric, Press TV decided to investigate how local Muslims live under these types of challenges.
The Muslim community that lives here in Poland is small but very passionate. It's estimated somewhere between 25 to 40,000 Muslims currently live in the country, making up about 0.1% of the current population, as it's estimated. The majority of them are native Tatars, but also there has been an immigration of Muslims to Poland from various countries. We've come here to one of the main mosques in the capital, Warsaw, to meet the community firsthand.
The imam explained that his main focus has always been to re-educate Poles about Islam and demonstrate Islamic teachings through good deeds.
We teach Quran, we teach Arabic language, and we teach something about Islam. Yes. During Ramadan, because Ramadan is near now, we're making soon 1992, we're making food and iftar for everybody. Every day. From time to time, also, we're making open day. This is for non-Muslims to come to our mosque, to hear something and listen about Islam. We made in March open day, and during this activity, 5 women accept Islam.
Despite these successes, Islamophobia still rears its ugly head from time to time. But the mosque uses Islam to combat this also.
One time only, the Polish youth came in front of this masjid and said some bad words about Islam. But I went to them and invited them to here to take a cup of tea, and they became friendly.
In past years, it was Islamic immigration that was considered the major threat in Eastern Europe. Now it's Russia. But conflict in Europe has historically catapulted dangerous ideologies into the forefront. Muslims in Europe look on with caution. Robert Carter, Warsaw.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining me in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Our topic is, again, a continuation of the previous session's topic, a question that we do not expect to have such a field of research behind it and so many different and opinions and views, but alas, it is what it is. We mentioned two views previously about whether or not people who are sentenced to eternity in the hellfire will actually spend eternity. One view was yes, that they will. The other was yes and no at the same time. They will grow accustomed to the hellfire and then it would not count as punishment for them anymore. And then we mentioned the third one was that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he may not act upon this promise out of mercy. And then we said that there were two objections to this, and we will talk about these objections and the answers given by the believers of this theory. So, dear Sheikh, please enlighten us.
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned, the main answer which is given to this question based on the verses and the narrations is that the eternity is true and it will happen because of the intentions of the both good doers and bad doers, and as put by Mullah Sadra, because of the second nature that these wicked people receive after committing so many sins. The third answer mentioned by a group of scholars is that we have good promises that we call wa'd, and then we have some threats that we call wa'id.
Right.
So is it necessary for God to act upon his wa'd? Yes. All people believe that the answer is positive. Is it necessary upon Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to act upon his wa'id, his threats? This group of scholars believe that not necessarily. It is possible for God not to act upon some of his threats out of his mercy. Now, before that, let me refer to one point. Some people may object and argue that this viewpoint may encourage many people not to obey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala anymore and to commit sins and so on and so forth.
Using this as an excuse.
Exactly. But the answer is that, first of all, this third answer is only a possibility. So these scholars, they say that maybe Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, out of his great mercy, will not act upon this part of his threat, that is eternity.
Right.
So will it happen For sure, we do not know. I mean, these scholars do not say that for sure eternity is not there.
Right. It's a theory.
Yeah, it's a theory. So people should not consider it as, I mean, a guarantee that khulud is not there for sure. No, it is just a theory. That the question is that, is it necessary for God to act upon all the threats? The answer of this group of scholars is that not necessarily. Maybe it is likely that he does not act upon this special threat, that is eternity in the hellfire. So, I mean, as people, we shouldn't fool ourselves. We right. should not, I mean, base our life on just this theory.
Of course, you're still going to spend some time in hell.
That's another point that I will come to it. But the first point is that this answer is just raising a theory about the possibility of God right. not acting upon that threat of eternity in the hellfire.
Also, it is not the mainstream view, by the way.
It's not the mainstream view.
So many people disagree with this, exactly. just to expand.
The majority of the scholars, they agree with that answer, that eternity is there right. because of the intentions, because of the second nature, and so on and so forth.
Right.
I'm just raising, just to let the people know that this is another viewpoint. They may research right. more about that. But it doesn't mean that this viewpoint encourages the people to disobey and commit sins. No. First of all, this is only a theory. Second of all, these people do not claim that punishment is not there at all. Their point is only about eternity. But it doesn't mean that these people will not be punished. And when we read the narrations that, I mean, one moment in the hellfire and like one drop of those punishments in the hellfire is enough to destroy the whole universe.
Right.
And so on and so forth. I think as people, we should be...
shouldn't think that, yeah, I can handle that.
Yeah, I mean, we shouldn't take it lightly. It's too serious.
Yeah.
So whether we are going to stay in the hellfire for one moment or for eternity, even to, I mean, tolerate one moment, it's not an easy task.
Yeah.
I mean, all the verses that are in the Noble Book of Quran and in the narrations, I think they are enough for us not to be too hopeful. At the end of the day, as mentioned by the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt,
Even hope, I'm sorry to interrupt you, to be too evident is a stupidity.
Exactly.
There's not even hope anymore.
Yeah. So we should keep a kind of moderation between khawf, fear of these punishments, and hope, raja, of the mercy of Allah.
That's the way of the Quran.
That is the way of the Quran, and as mentioned by the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, we should be hopeful of the mercy of Allah, subhanahu wa ta'ala, but we shouldn't go to extreme of committing sins. We should be fearful of the punishment of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but shouldn't go to the extreme of getting disappointed of the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Right.
So this viewpoint doesn't at all encourage the people to commit sins. At the end of the day, people will be punished. This is only about khulud, about eternity. In the hellfire, they say that theoretically speaking, it is possible for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala not to act upon this part of his threat.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Insha'Allah, you'll find your way. Now, these scholars. This group of scholars, they have referred to a couple of verses of the Quran to support their idea, like the verse which reads, قَالَ النَّارُ مَثْوَاكُمْ, say, the hellfire is your abode, خَالِدِينَ فِيهَا, you will be there forever, إِلَّا مَا شَاءَ رَبُّكُمْ, except if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wishes otherwise. The same has been mentioned in the verse that I recited in the previous session, فَأَمَّا الَّذِينَ شَقُوا فَفِي النَّارِ, the wicked people are in the hellfire. Then it says, خَالَدِينَ فِيهَا مَا دَمَتَ السَّمَوَاتُ وَالْأَرْضِ, they will be in the hellfire for eternity as long as the heavens and the earth are there. إِلَّا مَا شَاءَ رَبُّكَ. Again, there is an exception.
Right.
So they believe that these two verses in the Noble Book of Quran, they mention that the eternal punishment is based on the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So at least it is possible that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, after punishing these people for some times, which might be very long time, he wills to deliver these people from the hellfire.
Right.
Now, the next point is that I think you mentioned in the previous session that the oppressed people might object Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or even the good doers, that we did a lot of good actions, and now you are claiming that the bad doers are not going to be in the hellfire right. forever.
Because their mercy is not as infinite as Allah's mercy.
Exactly. Now, the point is that, again, I'm just answering these questions from these scholars' viewpoint.
From their perspective.
Yeah, from right. their perspective.
It isn't that, your own opinion
yeah,
or our
Yeah, it's not
opinion.
My opinion.
Right.
So the point is that, first of all, they will be punished. I do want to put emphasis on this notion that for sure they will be punished. There is no doubt about that.
Right.
The only issue is about eternity in the hellfire. And the concept of eternity is, I mean, one of the difficult concepts to think about.
We cannot understand eternity.
Exactly, we cannot understand it. So when we say that it is possible for God not to punish them eternally, it doesn't mean that they will not be punished at all. As I mentioned, one moment of punishment may be, it's too serious for
right.
all the people to tolerate.
It is too hurtful. It
exactly.
is too, it's too
so
much.
It doesn't mean that the oppressive people will be like the oppressed people. No, it's a
right.
very, very, very big difference. They will be punished for years and years and years. So this is one point. And the second point is that at the end of the day, even if these people are going to be delivered from, eternal punishment, it doesn't mean that they will be enjoying paradise as the oppressed people, as the people who did righteous actions.
Because there are degrees
exactly.
and statures in heaven as
in
well.
Both hell and the heavens, we have so many levels.
Right.
So people who go to paradise, they are not in the same level. So we shouldn't think that, this is against the justice of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. No. Even if it happens that after being punished for so many years...
Theoretically, of course.
Theoretically speaking,
right.
eternity in the hellfire is not there. They will not be in the same level as the people who did righteous actions
right.
in this world.
So rest assured, people of Jannah, inshallah.
Exactly.
You will have your own maqamat and statues and all of that.
Exactly. So having said that, let me... share with the dear listeners that this is not the main answer given by the Shia scholars.
Right.
What we received from the verses and the narrations is that khulud, eternity in both the paradise and in the hellfire is there. Many verses of the Quran have used the term khalidina fiha or the similar ones. And we have only two verses which makes a kind of exception and exclusion, like Illa
right.
Masha'a Rabbuk. And when we refer to the narrations, there are so many narrations in this regard. So the main answer given to this question is that, yes, eternity, of course, no one doubts about the eternity in the paradise, but for eternity in the hellfire, based on the verses and the narrations, eternity in the hellfire is there. And the explanation is that we mentioned in the previous session that it is because of the fact that people are going to repeat the same action. We are not going about the majority of the people
right.
who will be punished. We are going about a select few of the people who, if they live on the earth for good, they will not change. They will commit the same sins again and again and again. We are only talking about
right.
this group of people. Philosophically speaking, Mullah Sadr puts it in another way. He calls it a tabiatu thanawiya, a second nature that is received by these people. The main nature shared by all the people is that divinely given nature, al-fitratu ilahiyya. But these people, after committing all these sins, they lose that nature. They receive a second nature, which means that whether they live for one moment or for 1,000 years or millions of years,
no
they
difference.
Will continue and they will not change. And that is the reason that they will be in the hellfire for eternity. This is the main answer given to this question.
And on that note, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. Dear Sheikh,